You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. And I'm going to tell you why I'm excited for today's guest. It's because it's something different. And we've talked with a ton of hardcore bow hunters. We've talked with, you know, the public land run and gun guy who's, you know, really good at killing big bucks and stuff like this. Trad guys. I mean, I'm sitting at like 950 episodes of the Nine Finger Chronicles. And I don't know if we're gonna, or if I've ever talked to someone who as passionate about flintlock muzzleloaders as today's guest, Mr. Andrew Wills. Thanks for coming on, man. I appreciate it.
Man, thanks for having me. I am a longtime listener.
And, thank you.
Yeah, I'm definitely a fan. So it was kind of cool when you asked me, but yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. And, you know, this is kind of full circle moment for me.
That's awesome, man. That's what this is all about. Okay. First off, I'm just going to say some bullet points first off. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So we're going to talk about you growing up, you know, and maybe some hunting. We'll talk about the hunting and how that got involved. We're going to talk about music because you're a songwriter. We're going to talk a little bit about American history. We're definitely going to talk about muzzleloaders and things like that. And so I think this is going to be a really, really fun podcast. But do you, like, to kick it off, do you have any kids?
Yes, I've got two.
Two?
I've got a son and a daughter, yep.
Okay. All right. And how old are they?
My son is 18 and my daughter is 15.
And 15?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're like one, maybe two steps above me when it comes to kids.
Yeah.
So right now, my daughter is coming out of a stage in her life where she was very easy. My daughter was very easy up until right now. And all I'm going to say is there's change coming, right? That's all I'm going to say. There's change coming.
And then from this side, I can assure you, yes, you are right. It's coming.
So, am I ready for it? Am I ready for it?
You never can be.
I love it. And my boys, they are wild. They have been wild. Like, climb up a tree, fall down, get hurt, cry, shake it off, rub dirt on it. Like, they're boys. And now they're coming out of a stage where they're becoming more independent and they're easier. I feel like they're getting easier to parent. Like, and so I just was kind of curious, since you're in that second stage, if like what your experience has been with girls and boys.
It's not terrible, but it is, the change comes and there's a little more headbutting, a little more opinions. You know, you're starting to develop who you are as a person and you're thinking your own way. And it, you know, I think it's even harder for my wife, especially with my daughter. Like, that's where the headbutting happens more than anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty normal. My son, a lot of my fans know this. He has cerebral palsy and he's in a wheelchair. Yeah. And so the hunting he gets to do is like in a ground blind and he's hanging out with me. He's also not known for being quiet. So it's kind of a hurdle I've had to deal with in the past. But I've also noticed that animals he hollers out because he can't talk, so he's more like
Yeah,
animals aren't intimidated by that at all, I've found out.
Oh,
they're just kind of like, oh, that's a non-threat. Like, they can tell. It's very interesting.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And even outside of hunting season, I've picked up on this because I've lived in places where I had acreage and animals around, and just having him outside, they won't even lift their head up. It's interesting. Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. Meanwhile, my kid's coming to the woods, and all you see is whitetails everywhere. Yeah. Running away. Yeah. Turkeys aren't gobbling anymore. Dad, what's wrong? I don't know, son. You haven't shut up since we've gotten here.
Love it.
But I will say this, on a serious note, it's awesome that you involve your kid in the outdoors when he's wheelchair bound, and yeah, maybe like other people or other parents would have said, and you see it all the time, I'm not going to give this opportunity to them.
Yeah.
And you have. And that's amazing. I like that.
It's not easy, obviously.
Exactly. It's not easy.
It's not. But I cherish the moments, you know. It's a lot harder when you're pulling in it with a, you know, handicapped van instead of your Silverado or whatever, you know, and then you're wheeling in. It's, you know, he's only gone a handful of times so far, but their memories I'll always have, and yeah, that's a big deal. So
yeah. Wow, that's awesome. Can you tell his excitement when he's out there?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He loves hanging with Dad. You know, it doesn't matter what, if we're at a baseball game or we're working in the garage. Like, he's pumped to be there. I took him to see Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers right before Tom Petty passed away here in Nashville, and Joe Walsh opened up, and he was just like grinning ear to ear just at the loud music. You know, he was all about it. And those kind of moments are pretty cool because he's very excitable. You can definitely tell.
Yeah. Can I ask you expand on this and ask you a really personal question?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, as fathers, we have these expectations about what our sons are going to be like before they're even born. Like, for me, it's just like, oh my God, I was excited about my daughter, but there's something about a son and a father in that bond, right?
Yeah.
And so you got these expectations that before the kid's even born, like, oh my God, I'm going to do this with him. I'm going to teach him how to fish. We're going to go camping and all that stuff. How was that for you, having to potentially change your expectations because your boy had the cerebral palsy?
I mean, it was tough, you know. It was very tough. And in some ways, I'm still dealing with it. It's you know, it's not just like a chapter that you get through. It's an ongoing thing. But early on, it wasn't a big deal. He was little.
Yeah.
He was, you know, hanging out with mom, you know, while I'm gone. And you didn't think about it. But as he got into teenage years, that's when it started hitting your heart. It's like, man, he's supposed to be, you know, riding the quad around, or he's supposed to be climbing up in the trees and hanging out, you know. It's heavy stuff, you know. And I definitely, you know, it was a real come to Jesus moment, no doubt, when I was going through a lot of that. And I still, sometimes when I hit the woods, it's a little melancholy, but I'm a little more at peace in these days with it. And I'm a little more like, you know, I do wish and I do long for that, but I think I'm a little more settled, you know, inside with how things are and the experiences we've had. You know, when he was little, I used to do some pretty cool backpack trips, and I would put him on my back and we would hike up mountains, and I did until I couldn't do it anymore. You know, he's heavy now. So
Yeah. Man, that's a tough, you know, hand of cards for your son, obviously. But just for everybody that's involved with that. And I don't, like, it's one of those things where I can sit here and I can try to imagine what you're going through, but I other than talking to you about it, I can't, you know, you never actually know what other people are going through in their life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Especially over social media, you know, you see certain snippets of people's lives and you can kind of, you get a glimpse into it, but you know, the day to day of everybody's life is, you know, it's not as sexy as we all make it out to be.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Actually, isn't there, man, what's his name? He is on one of the NBA, he's in a broadcaster for the NBA and he works alongside, Shaq and Charles Barkley and Kenny Perkins or somebody anyway, it's on the NBA, but they did a documentary about him and his adult son, who is also fully in a wheelchair, can't give himself showers. So like every morning before he comes into work, he shaves his kid, helps him with the bath, does all the tubes and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And it was actually really eye-opening to see the amount of I don't want to call it work.
Right.
Because it's your child.
Right.
But the amount of dedication it takes to just make that one person's life exist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's definitely, everything you just described hit home with me and my daily routine and stuff. It's, you know, it's part of just being a father, you know, it's being a parent. It's what you do, you know?
Right.
And there's days it sucks, you know, there's days you're just like, man. And but then there's days where you're just like, you know, this ain't that bad. And you know, it's kind of good for me. It kind of keeps me in check too, you know. And sometimes I think the Lord did that to me on purpose so that I would, you know, kind of keep myself in check. I don't know. It's humbling, you know. But he is my boy, you know.
That's a fact.
And let me tell you, if I tell a little, you know, off color joke, my girls are rolling their eyes, and guess who's laughing? He's all boy.
Yeah. 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 I love it. Because I do the same thing. Like in our house, I'll fart or some shit.
Yeah.
And my daughter and my wife will be like, ooh, gross. Ooh, gross. Yep. And my boys are just high fiving me, like, good one, Dad. Good one, Dad. Love it.
Yep.
Love it. It sucks that I have to do this now after that like real serious conversation, but I do have to take a minute here and send a huge shout out to the partners of this podcast. So if you're interested in learning how to saddle hunt, like any type of saddle hunting gear or accessories, they have an awesome turkey hunting backpack that they've come out with. Go check out Tethered's website. Tons of great products there, tons of great content that they put out every year. Reveal trail cameras. I'm running the new 3.0 versions this year. They're a badass trail camera, easy to use, very affordable. Go to tacticam.com/cameras. Wasp Archery, in my opinion, some of the best broadheads on the market. Absolutely love those heads. And a majority of their heads are made in the USA. So go to wasparchery.com and go pick your favorite broadhead that you think you're going to slay with, and enter the discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is, let's see, what we did that one. Oh, Code Blue Sense, real synthetic deer urines. I am a huge fan of the mock scrape kits that they have, the Rope-A-Dope mock scrape kits. They've just come out with a 2-pack of that. That's one of their new product offerings. So go to codebluesense.com, discount code NFC20. And last but not least, we got two more actually. We got Huntworth. If you're looking for an affordable, badass, high quality camo and clothing company, go check out huntworthgear.com. And then, of course, my company, Full Sneak Gear, which is probably the best one, obviously. fullsneakgear.com. I got some fun sweatshirts and t-shirts and hats that you guys can go wear, and basically when you're wearing that, it basically says I'm a hunter and I like to hunt and I like to have fun. So okay, I've whored out now. Okay,
love it.
Love it. Andrew, what year were you born?
1981.
Oh, dude. 81.
Yeah.
So we're the same age.
Ooh,
I was born in 1980. Right. What was your favorite cartoon in the 80s?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I definitely watched, you know, I was a sucker for Inspector Gadget. I liked Transformers.
Yes.
I liked Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yep.
I guess that wasn't a cartoon. That was a movie, but.
That would have been like early 90s, late 80s,
yes.
Early 90s.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I got two. And I'll tell you, the reason I like them is the order of in which. Okay. So I was raised on a farm. My grandparents, they were the kind of people, farming family, but, and my mom and dad dropped me off on the farm and then they'd pick me up when they're done with work. So I was basically babysat by my, grandparents. So afternoon, here's the afternoon. What would happen? General Hospital was my grandma's soap opera. So she would watch it every day at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah. Right after that, back to back, Masters of the Universe.
Oh.
And G.I. Joe.
Yes.
And then that would take us into Jeopardy.
Uh-huh.
Okay. With Alex Trebek, right? And so I don't know if I ever missed, and I'm talking for years, an episode of Masters of the Universe and G.I. Joe's.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's good. That's a good lineup, actually.
Yeah. So now we have reference, right? 81,
yes.
Kind of.
Yeah.
I know the culture that you probably lived in and things mm-hmm. like that. Where were you born?
Xenia, Ohio.
Ohio. Okay.
Yeah,
tell me about Xenia, Ohio back in the 80s.
It was pretty quiet. Technically, I grew up in Spring Valley, Ohio, which is just, you know, like 8 miles from Xenia, but little town of like 180 people. It's lots of corn, lots of, you know, hardwood stands, you know, connecting different fields and crops. And, you know, it was flat. It was deer country for sure.
Yeah.
The Greene County is where Xenia's at. And the biggest buck in Ohio history up until like fairly recently was taken in Greene County. And it's just good country farmland and down home people and just hardworking folk. And it was a great place to grow up. I rode my bike everywhere, you know, until I got my first 1987 Dodge Dakota. And then I drove everywhere in that bad boy with the headliner like drooping down on my head. And
God, I've been in, you don't even need to say the style of car. I've been in a car that's been so old that, or maybe like you bought it from like my grandpa had this, like an old truck that had it, but he was a smoker. So he would go to flick his cigarettes out the window, and then all of the burn marks on the like the foam droopy ceiling right there by the window. So
I love it.
Yep.
I love it.
So were you born into a family of hunters, or is this something you picked up on your own?
A little bit of both. My grandpa was a big hunter, grew up in that generation. He lived in Michigan for a while, and that was just like, you know, school was out on opening day. Like it was just a different era, you know. And my dad, he's more the fisherman. He just lived on he loved fishing. And I picked up that bug too. I love fishing as well, but
yeah.
He just never was the hunting guy. He was my grandpa and my uncle. They were big into hunting, and my uncle didn't live nearby. He was up in like northern Indiana, southern Michigan, and I was in southern Ohio. So while I had occasional help, you know, from family, it was a lot of my own just figuring things out the hard way. And then like at Thanksgiving, getting some tips and stuff like that. So a little bit of both would be the answer. And anyway, so I definitely learned some things the hard way.
Oh, yeah.
And
Yeah.
You know, but
did you have
those
a,
are the
like
lessons
a,
you remember.
Did you have a mentor kind of growing up that was there? And the reason I asked that is because there's a lot of guys I've talked to over the years that were that straight up said, no, I learned to hunt by myself. My parents maybe bought me the bow. They weren't hunters, or they bought me the gun. They said I could go, but they weren't involved in it. Or you had a buddy's dad or somebody that you got hooked up with. Was there a mentor that helped you when you were young that was close?
I would say no, really. I mean, this was before YouTube and all that stuff. You know, this was, I had to go to the library to find books, or I had to figure things out the hard way. I had a guy who I knew from church who had like an old PSE compound, and he had upgraded, and he was like, hey, do you want this? And I was like, yeah. And that was my first like legit bow. But even he, I wouldn't call a mentor, because I never went hunting with him or anything. It was, it was more like this, there was a, you know, a distance there where they were willing to give advice, but like, you know, the convenience of getting on the same, you know, piece of ground just never happened. My grandpa, though, I did go in my later teens a couple times during like muzzleloader season, and I got out with him several times, but yeah, a lot. I just learned by getting out there.
Yeah. How old were you when you started getting out there?
I was like 16.
Yeah.
16. I'd go out by myself at 16, find some public land and, you know, try archery. And I did like around 17, I had a friend who was kind of similar. Like he was all gung ho. I want to learn how to do this, but he didn't really have anybody teaching him either. And we were just figuring things out together.
Yeah.
And I was learning from his mistakes and he was learning from mine. And that was a good time, you know, cause that sped up the learning curve a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds to me like right around the time you got a car is the time that you started spreading your wings and just getting more into hunting. Did you go to college or have a period of time where you got into hunting and then you got out of hunting and then you got back into hunting, or was this it, or has hunting always been consistent?
It's been mostly consistent. I did go to college. I went to business school at Wright State University right there in Dayton, Ohio. And it was a busy time. You know, I was working a full-time job at the same time, and I was, you know, doing grown up things, and I'd go out for, you know, gun season 1 or 2 days. And that was the extent of it, cause that's all I had time for. And then it wasn't until after I graduated, my wife graduated and we moved to Pennsylvania, that I met a coworker, and his whole family had some land, and he's like talking about hunting. And I was like, oh, I love hunting. I haven't been in a couple years. And he was like, oh, well, come with us. And I got back into it, and that was all rifle hunting in Pennsylvania. And that was a great experience getting back in the woods. And it wasn't until I left Pennsylvania and we moved to Southeast Ohio, Gallipolis, Ohio, when I really got to start putting time in the woods, because I bought a piece of ground that had it held deer, you know, in Turkey. Okay. So
gotcha.
That's when I really started to go to school.
What year was that?
That would have been 2007, 2008, maybe.
Okay. All right. And so you bought that piece of ground. I mean, it sounds to me like you got it, like you got into it through the rifle hunting with some people in Pennsylvania. You moved back home, you bought some ground, and it sounded like that was one of the key indicators that you're like, okay, now I have it. I'm going to spend more time in it.
Yeah.
Is that when you picked up a bow?
Yeah, it was there, you know, I was able to do it, and I wasn't having to drive 2 hours to get to it. And I had the passion for it. In Ohio at the time, you had archery, which was big at the time, but You can't hunt with rifles in Ohio. It's shotgun or muzzleloader only for the rifle season. So
yeah.
I inherited my grandpa's Hawken, 50 caliber Hawken percussion cap rifle. And I was like, well, why would I use a shotgun when I could use this? Because I can drop something at 170 yards with this. And and I grew up obsessed with American history and Daniel Boone and movies like Jeremiah Johnson and Last of the Mohicans and all that stuff. So it pulled at me anyway. And I ended up taking my first deer ever with that Hawken. And that's when it started for me, like the really started cooking.
That's interesting because you hunted all those years without killing a deer. And then it wasn't until you picked up this almost ancient.
Yeah.
You know, because obviously there's other weapons out there that are more sophisticated, more technologically advanced. And the first deer was with a percussion. Like, what's the technical term for that? Is it flintlock or is it?
That one was a percussion cap.
Okay.
Muzzle loader. So it's got the hammer on the side.
Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
In it. Smashes onto a cap. Just it was kind of the predecessor to a cartridge where the cap is on the back of a shell. So it's that same technology that kept developing.
And so
LifeLock, how can I help?
The IRS said I filed my return,
but I haven't.
1 in 4 taxpaying Americans has paid the price of identity fraud.
What do I do?
My refund, though.
I'm freaking out.
Don't worry, I can fix this.
LifeLock fixes identity theft guaranteed and gets your money back with up to $3 million in coverage.
I'm so relieved.
No problem. I'll be with you every step of the way.
1 in 4 was a fraud-paying American. Not anymore. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
You shot your first deer with this muzzleloader, and then was it kind of like, I love muzzleloaders? Or when did you start to get crazy about muzzleloaders?
That happened earlier, actually, because of the history aspect. I actually bought a kit when I was a kid, and I put together a Kentucky long rifle, and where you had to sand it and stain it and do all that stuff and finish the barrel. And so I was always kind of a geek on that stuff anyway.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be Daniel Boone so bad. So I think I wanted to hunt that way.
Yeah.
That being said, I mean, I'll hunt every season. I mean, I just like being in the woods. So
yeah.
I'm not exclusively muzzleloader, but it's just my, it's my happy place for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is kind of, you brought it up and I'm going to ask about it, is like, obviously firearms played a huge role in American history. They pretty much, you know, made the country what it is. And so why this connection to American history, and why does like the weapon that you use when you go hunting, like this muzzleloader, connect with that? So now you have two passions that are intertwined.
Right. Yeah. So in the area I grew up in Ohio, it is rich in frontier history. The frontiersman Simon Kenton roamed this area, hunted. He was a market hunter at the time, and he built, you know, town. He built the town of Maysville, Kentucky. You had Tecumseh, the great Shawnee warrior, literally was born miles from where I grew up. Daniel Boone. There was all this history, and these literally, there were historical markers I drove by every day to go everywhere. And I became really interested in what happened on the very ground. I was not just going to school or, you know, hanging out, but actually hunting the woods. I was like, who used to hunt these woods? And so that connection was big. And then I also liked the challenge of just doing something a little different. I've always been a little different, you know? So I don't know. There's something, you know, you see Daniel Day-Lewis running through the woods with a flintlock and Last of the Mohicans, and you're like, man, that looks pretty cool. And I just always wanted, I wanted a flintlock, you know, and I eventually wound up, I still have that percussion cap Hawking, but I finally got my flintlock and I have my powder horn and shooting bag and all that stuff. And it's just, I don't know, you feel like a real connection to the past, because if you think about it, the woods, it's pretty much the same. I mean, like, yeah, it's a new growth, it's new, but those, I mean, those deer are the ancestors of the deer that Daniel Boone hunted. Yeah. Those, you know, those coyotes you see, I mean, running on the horizon, I mean, their ancestors once roamed back when the you know, the Cherokee roamed over these ridge lines. So it's, to me, when I think back like that, it's cool, because it's like this, not only a connection, but you kind of have a little bit of responsibility. You, like, you feel like, wow, like this is special that I get to do this. And I don't know, I'm passionate about that.
Yeah. And that's worthwhile, you know, that's worth being passionate about, because, man, I don't know what it is recently. And when I say recent, I'd say last 5 years. It's about 5 years ago. I was walking out of the timber and I found an arrowhead. I literally stopped and was looking around, and then I looked down at my feet and there it was, just like right in between my boots. And it was a good arrowhead. Like, it's got a little bit of a corner chipped off, but other than that, it's intact. About a mile up the creek, when I could hunt a different property, I found another one in the bank of a river. This one was long and skinny, almost like it was on maybe an arrow tip or a spear or whatever. This one would have been a bigger spear tip. Anyway, what I'm getting at is, you sit there and you think, like, man, 4,000 years ago, anywhere from 800 to 4,000 years ago, somebody was here hunting or protecting themselves or whatever the case is, and I'm now in the same spot that they were. And here I am holding like this bow that the technology, they wouldn't even recognize what it does unless I told them, right? And so it's pretty cool to just know that you're walking in the same footsteps of people thousands of years before you, potentially. And so I've always kind of, like, Native American history, I've really kind of gotten into that. So anytime there's a documentary on, I've actually talked with like a Native American historian from Iowa here, and talked okay. about the Indian tribes that were living in this area of the country and all that stuff. And it's so interesting. And then I think that connection mixed with my connection for Wild Places is my brain's always working. So like when I go out to South Dakota or Colorado, and I always think, how many people have been where I'm at right now? How many, you know, hundreds yeah. of years or thousands of years before me, has there been a person that walked this same creek or crossed here, because the terrain just, that's where the crossings are at. And so I don't know. That's really interesting.
It is. I can live off of that for a while. Just the, you know, the thought process back to, like, you get up on some vista and you're like looking over some valley out west or something, and you're like, you know, somebody stood here and took this in at one point along the yeah. way, whether it was, you know, some Cheyenne warrior or some mountain man, you know, fur yep. trapper looking for a good place to put some beaver traps or whatever. Like, yeah. it just, you know, it makes you a little more appreciative, I think, of, you know, what we get to do here when you think about those who came before us.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, from a hunting standpoint, okay, so you got this little, this, all these things that are starting to tie in to make you who you are. What is it about hunting per se that, you know, because I know a lot of people who are into history, but not all of them are into hunting. What's your connection with hunting?
It's number one, I think it's a huge part of history, especially American history. Yep. Not just the fur trade, but just the people who survived by hunting. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, they got their food from hunting. They got their clothes from hunting. It was just a way of life. And, so part of me is, you know, honoring that tradition for sure. And another part of it is I love the taste of venison, you know, I love it. You know, I pulled some, jalapeno cheddar, venison snack sticks out of the freezer this morning to defrost while we're talking here. So, I'm a fan, you know. And then on top of it all, I just love being in the woods. I love watching that sun come up on a crisp fall morning, you know, and
yeah. Sounds cliche to say it, but
it does,
but it's real. It's something yeah. real. And the feelings mm-hmm. you get from it are real. And I don't know, that's just part of the reason why I do what I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So this is interesting, because now this next step is obviously, you have this unique view. You love hunting all season. So you hunt with a bow and you hunt with your muzzleloader and whatnot, but you're also a songwriter,
yeah.
right? You currently reside in Nashville, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you're a songwriter. Is that your main gig?
It is my main gig. I've been in town now for about 15 years, and it's, you know, it's been an up and down experience, but I'm established enough that's what I do. And it's fun, you know. It's fun. It's a lot of hard work too.
Yeah.
But I'm in the place to do it, though. Nashville. Yeah. Nashville's Music City for a reason.
Yeah. Awesome. So with all this that we've already just talked about, how much of your passion carries over into the music that you write?
It a lot now, especially. When I first got to town, I was just trying to, you know, get a Tim McGraw cut. You know, I was just trying to write songs and pitch them. And but the longer I got here, I kind of got disenchanted with the rat race of just trying to write a song about beer on a tailgate. And I was like, I need something a little more fulfilling. And I started writing music for me, only for me. I wasn't even, you know, if it found some sort of success, that'd be awesome. But I started writing the music for Hawk and Horse about 3 years ago.
What's Hawk and Horse?
Hawk and Horse is my outdoor history frontier music project, where I write music about the American frontier. And it's songs about Daniel Boone, Jedediah Smith, John Coulter, Hugh Glass, these mountain men. I've songs about, you know, Native Americans, songs about building cabins. And it's very, I call it frontier folk music. It's kind of got a folky country vibe to it. And, you know, I just started releasing it, and I came up with the name Hawking Horse, if I'm honest, because I was slightly embarrassed. I was like, I don't want to use my name just in case it's like a flop. And I came up with the name Hawking Horse based on a Hawking rifle and a horse were the two most important things to a mountain man. Yeah. And anyway, it went off well. Like I can't even believe how many people listen, you know, and I get so many messages from people just saying, man, you changed my life, because they've looked for this music their whole life. And I was just like, really? And I found this whole community of people that hunt and love history. Some of them are, you know, they are black powder flintlock people, and that's all they use. Some of them use, you know, ARs, the hunt hogs, but they just resonate with the feeling of these songs, you know? And yeah. So anyway, that took on a life of its own. It's pretty wild.
That's crazy. Like, okay, so you basically said the stereotype of country western music, all right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, and you were struggling in that realm,
yeah.
But then you started doing something for you.
Yes.
Crazy how that works, right? It's like, once you do something that you're passionate about, you're going to find success.
Yeah.
Doing it, whatever your definition of success is. And so that's awesome, you know, to be able to just tie in. Like, you know, you think about, I don't know. I always think about this. This is crazy. I like rap music. I was born in an era where there was the growth of rap. I was influenced by rap. Could I relate to rap? Nope. You know, I never had any cops, right. You know, like beat my ass or anything like that. So I can't relate to any of that. But I liked rap music, but I also like, you know, country western. I love hunting. And so I'm trying to think, I wonder if there is a rap hunt genre out there where it's just some dude rapping about big bucks and turkeys, and he just loves the outdoors and things like that, with all the same energy and like vibe that rap music and urban music kind of have.
There's gotta be.
There's gotta be.
There's some fringe people but that's not all they talk about. You know, it's not all they sing about. So, you know, some of these, you know, like, I don't think Jelly Roll's much of an outdoorsman, but I know Post Malone is he gets out and hunts and stuff, and he's kind of going country, I think, right now. But
yeah, when all else fails, go country, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what everybody's doing it right now. It's like, well, I'm not getting the money that I want. Well, I'm going to go country, and I'm going to cross over.
Yeah.
And then I don't know. Anyway,
you're right.
Yeah. And so, okay, I love going to Nashville. I love the country western scene. I love the music writing scene that is all like in with that. How, like, when you started writing, how old were you when you started writing music? And, like, were you writing before you moved to Nashville, or was this I'm going to go to Nashville and I'm going to start?
Yeah, I wrote my first song right around when I started hunting, if we're honest. I was 15, 16. I think I heard, like, Metallica or something. I heard some rock song, and it might have been Metallica, but I was like, man, that's the words. I was always a word guy. I really was into the what was being said and the clever way of saying it. And I remember I wrote a song, and I was like, oh, that was fun. And then I just kind of did it as a hobby all throughout high school, but nobody knew. I never played it or showed anybody. And then when my wife and I left Pennsylvania, moved back to Ohio, my son was born, and he had cerebral palsy back then, and it was like, this is a life-altering moment. And I was like, what am I going to do? And so my wife had a good job, and we're like, she's got to work this for this to make sense. And I got to have a career change of some sort. I was working in business. I was working in the outdoor industry, actually, in the backpacking industry. And I was like, I'm going to have to come up with something I can do at my own pace and be my own boss to work around our new life here. So I was like, you know what? I always loved writing songs. I should just try writing some songs. And I wrote a bunch of songs, and I was sending them to people in Nashville and getting a little action here, there. And then,
what does that mean? You're sending your songs to people in Nashville. Like, who are these people?
Yeah. Okay. To like publishers, to pluggers, managers. And by action, I mean like people responding, number one, and number two, saying, oh, I like this. I sent this to so-and-so, like the artist, and I'm actually getting beyond the gatekeepers with my music. Yeah. And I had a real champion down here named Alex Torres, who still is a really dear friend to this day. And I was like, hey, Alex, should I move my family down there? And he was like, don't move down here unless you have to. Like, you know, don't, you know, you only come here if you just have to do it. And he's like, otherwise, just stay where you are. And then I thought about it. I was like, I got to get down there. I've just got to, because this is a big passion of mine, and it's a gift of mine. Like, I just writing songs. I'm going to write songs. That's just who I am. Yeah. And so my wife was supportive. She's like, let's go. And so we up and left Ohio, and we came to Nashville, and I was literally writing 7-8 songs a week with co-writes. I'd have them double booked. I'd have a 10 a.m. and then I'd have like a 3 p.m. And I was just like cranking out songs and meeting people. And I just threw myself in.
Yeah.
And, I was looking recently. I think I wrote like 500 songs in a matter of 3 years. And, a buddy of mine got signed to Brad Paisley's publishing company. And, I started getting songs pitched by their pluggers just because I wrote the songs with him, and things started happening. And then I had a couple small cuts, you know, like I had a cut by Andy Griggs that was on the radio. And then I had, some indie cuts and stuff like that. But then I wound up with a Jared Neiman single that was a top 40, and I got signed to Sony, and things started just happening, you know. And yeah. It's just wild how it happens, but it's, you know, it's an up and down ride, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't remember, like, one of the greatest songwriters of all time is probably like Dolly Parton, right?
Oh, sure.
She's got her name on what seems like 1,000 number one hits or however many. And then what are some of the other like big name Nashville songwriters?
Big name, like not artists, like Dolly, you know, has
she's crossover.
Artist. Yeah. But like Craig Wiseman's a famous one. He's written, I mean, I think he just celebrated his like 50th number one.
Yeah.
And cuts by Kenny Chesney and Tim McGraw and Brooks and Dunn and all throughout. Jeffrey Steele is another big one. Luke Laird is a more current one. Ross Copperman. There's a bunch of big heavyweights. Yeah. Ashley Gourley, I'd have to mention him because I think he might have the new record for most number ones by a songwriter. And he's, anyway.
What's it like for like a songwriter? You said you've put out 503 years, right? That's a lot of song, writing a lot of songs. And some of those probably don't ever see the light of day.
That's right.
Right? And so how long, like what on an average songwriter, right? I don't know whether you're average or above average or whatever the case is. How long does it take to get established as a songwriter, if at all?
They call it a 10-year town.
Okay.
I don't know how true that is. I mean, I know historically that's what it was, but you know, the music industry has changed a lot.
Meaning 10 years, you got to do something for 10 years to even get recognized.
Yeah, to start making money at it, you know, and to get enough songs recorded to justify it, you know, like that's a big investment of your life. That's a big chunk.
Yeah.
The way I was able to do it is that, you know, my wife's job was enough to get us through. And then when I had surges of, you know, of income, that's the thing. Like you get a song on the radio and you get all this money. And then the next year, you're getting like fractions. And so you're doing your taxes every year is always a thrill because it's just like all over the place.
Do you have a song that you still get money for that you've written several years ago?
Oh yeah. Blue Bandana by Jared Neiman was a good song. And I still get paid for that one. Stephanie Quayle had a song called Selfish a couple years back that still pays.
Do you have a song that's like, I make $4 a year off of the song, like, because that's how royalties work, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I've got a bunch of those.
Okay, so you have like all these added up songs are making like a decent amount of money for you through royalties.
Yeah, I remember talking to my plugger at Sony one time, and I was talking about this indie cut I had, and it was generating, you know, 9 cents or something a month or whatever. And I was just like, do you want me to register this? It's like literally 9 cents. It's making pennies. And he's like, Andy, we're in the penny business. so that kind of opened my eyes with Sony, like one of the biggest music conglomerates on earth was like, we're in the penny business. I was like, okay. So it kind of changed the way I looked at things. And it's a volume thing, you know, and I have hundreds of cuts by little indie acts, you know, but they add up to something, you know?
So there was a songwriter, a singer, back in the '80s who had this song, and I don't even know if it was popular at all when it first came out, but then it came out on Stranger Things.
Oh.
And then the original song started playing on the radio again. And through all the Stranger Things happening, and this chick just made bank.
That's
because
awesome.
Out of nowhere. So have you ever had a song that was dormant for a while and then maybe was used somewhere else that kind of flared back up again?
Not to that extreme.
Yeah.
But I've definitely had songs I wrote, you know, 7-8 years ago get recorded all of a sudden.
Okay.
You know, that's like deep catalog stuff. And yeah, I've got one. There's a new artist named Braxton Keith. He's on Warner Brothers and he's doing he's like a 90s country act. And he's got that sound.
He's young though, right?
He's super young. He's like 22, 23.
I think I've heard this kid before, but he's almost like he's bringing 90s country back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's like baritone guitars and it's got the pedal steel and all that stuff. And I have multiple cuts by him and I wrote his biggest song with him, Cozy. I co-wrote that one with him and we wrote that years ago.
Yeah.
And you know, and then one day I get a call, hey, we're going to cut that song. And oh, cool. And at the time he had nothing going on.
Yeah.
So I thought it was another indie cut. And I was like, okay, cool. And now it's, I looked at Spotify, I think it's got like 30 million plays. And I'm like, okay then.
So let me ask you a question. I want to talk money for a second.
Yeah.
Okay. With streaming, you write that song. Okay. Yeah. Are you the only songwriter on that song?
No, I wrote it with Braxton. So we were 50-50.
Yeah. 50-50 on it. Okay.
Yep.
30 million streams on the internet or wherever that's at. What does a songwriter make for that?
Yeah, it's painful because, like, if it was 1989 or 1994, you know, you're literally talking, I don't know, $500,000.
Yeah.
And now in the streaming world, I mean, you're talking 30K.
Yeah.
It's just night and day. It's painful. And the radio still pays, but the radio is just not what it was. I mean, everybody I know streams. It's just easier. You can make your own playlist. You don't have commercials. There's a million reasons why you stream.
Yeah.
Even I do. I mean, it's convenient. So
you
got to
keep
sense.
Up with the times, right?
Yeah.
You got to keep up with the times.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I'm
actually really fascinated about the music industry and hearing, a friend of ours in our town just got signed to, I don't know what do they call it, like a test run.
Well, yeah, okay.
They flew. She was on social media doing her thing. Someone saw her, called her to come fly to LA. They did a test where they recorded music with her. They did a photo shoot with her. They did like these interviews. And basically it was like 13 hours a day in a recording studio writing. And then they put like a package together, I guess. And then however they do a test market, they go it out there and they see how they react. If people react positively, then she gets signed to a bigger deal or whatever the case is. But it sounds like everything I've heard about record companies, you think that you're just making it big right off the bat, but then you're responsible for all of the payment that goes into making yourself popular.
Yeah. And any money you get up front, any advance, that all goes against your future earnings. Like you owe that.
Yeah.
That's not just cash that you just get the pocket. I mean, you're going to pay for that down the road. So in the modern world, you know, being an independent's actually pretty liberating. It's pretty great. I mean, you got people like Sturgill Simpson and Cody Johnson he's a great example. He was, you know, touring through Texas, selling out arenas on his own. Like he had no backing. It was him.
Yeah.
And for 10 years he did this, and he then went to the label with all the power, all the leverage, and got a deal in his favor where they're just working for him basically. So that's different than some kid just walking in and getting signed to what they call a 360 deal, which historically back in the 90s, we're talking about 90s music, the labels just participated in record sales. But nowadays, even like Jason Aldean famously signed a 360 deal, which means the label participated in merch, they participated in touring, they had a cut of everything. And Jason Aldean took it because he was getting nowhere. And he has a song about it. I forget what it's called, but he mentions it. They're about to repossess his truck, you know, and it's called Crazy Town, I think.
Okay.
Anyway, he's got a song, I think it's called Crazy Town, and it talks about, that's all real stuff, like he sings about in there. Like he was literally, they were coming to impound his truck and he got signed. And now Broken Bow Records is like one of the bigger indie labels because of him.
Yeah.
And they took a chance on him, and they were nothing. beforehand.
So is a 360 deal a good thing or a bad thing?
It's not good for an artist because you're giving up a ton.
Yeah.
But
giving up a ton when you don't have anything, like, that's not, that's still a net positive for you, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you independent?
Wait, what?
Are you independent?
Yeah, I am now. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
I am now. And
so
what
happens? Yeah. So what happens? I mean, you leave, like an organization, you go independent. I would assume, like, people, if you leave a contract, they don't want to work with you anymore. They want to work with people who have contracts. Like,
right.
But you must be established in a way to where people respect what you're doing in order to keep working with you even after said contracts expired.
Exactly. And that's kind of I've built up all these relationships, and there's people I met when I first got to town, and now they're running A&R for Universal, or they're managing so-and-so now. Like, it's, we've come up together, and now I know these people, and we're friends, and we, you know, it's just kind of the nature of the, you know, how the business operates as people retire and people move up the chain. But yeah, I've built some relationships, not only with writers and artists, but, you know, with labels and publishers. And I had somebody asking if I wanted to sign, you know, if I was looking for anything. And I was like, not right now. You know, I'm pretty happy where I am. Because with a publishing deal comes some expectations. Like, you got to be pumping out songs and writing with new people and artists, you know, that may or may not be able to write a good song, and it's really painful.
Yeah. Is it fun? I mean, if you said, Dan, let's sit down and write a song about the woods and how nature or whatever the case is, I would be like, dude, that would be fun. That sounds like fun. Is writing a song fun, or in your position, is it stress?
Oh, it's definitely fun. It can turn into stress for sure, especially when you add in things like, this is your only co-write with this person. They're recording at the end of the month. You've got, you know, you've got a third writer that you don't know very well. Like, you add in all these factors, and now it's just like, it becomes stressful. But the actual process of writing a song is fun for sure. But you know, and I have the most fun when I'm writing with just another songwriter who's a great writer and thinks the way I think. And it just happens. Like, it's so easy, and you're laughing the whole time, and it's fun. But then sometimes you get stuck. Like, for instance, I had a writer, I won't say who she was, but she was a very pop, quote unquote, country artist. And whose favorite singer was like Rihanna or something. And I come from like country. I like George Strait. And like, this is the stuff I came from. It's like oil and water. Like, we tried to write a song, and it was just like, it was terrible. And it's about matching your skills and tastes with the right people. And you find your group, or your tribe, or what they call it, different things, you know, your people that you write well with. Somebody I would definitely recommend checking out is Brett Scirocchi. I write with him a lot. He's a great, great songwriter and singer, and he's getting ready to drop a record, and I've got a song on it. But he's somebody that I can sit down and write with, and I'm laughing the whole time, and he's a dad, you know, like us, and he's just a guy, and you know, but you can also get deep and write some like real stuff, and you leave thinking, man, we wrote a great song today. And you can really fulfill the songwriter itch, you know, because when you're a songwriter, like, you know, you can only write so many party songs or whatever, you know, like, it's, sometimes you want to write a Live Like You're Dying or you know, The Dance or whatever. So,
Interesting, dude. Interesting. Yeah. And with all of that, you still find time to get out in the woods.
I do. Yes, in fact, I have been known to like block my calendar in November. Like it's not available. And I had one write. I was like, oh my gosh, I guess I'll take this write. And it was right there in the middle of the rut. I'm like, what am I thinking? But I'm glad it did because I got the song cut. So I was like, okay, at least it wasn't a wasted day.
Well, the other thing is, you know, within the country music scene, the culture, even into the folk scene, there's a hint of hunting, right? I mean, it would be sweet to just be like, all right, dude, today we're riding in the woods while I'm calling turkeys, right?
Yes.
So have a little pocketbook and you take your notes or whatever, shoot a turkey, you know, or walk back to the truck and like that whole experience could turn into something. And so, I don't know, I can see, have you ever written a song while you're in the tree stand?
I have. I can tell you one time in particular, my buddy Chad and I were riding with 90s country star Andy Griggs.
Okay.
He's a big old hunter. And it was turkeys. It was this time of year. And we went out to the woods and we were working on the second verse of this song. And we heard a cluck way out. And we were like, oh, and we were like stopping. We were literally, it was like a country song itself. We were sitting on the tailgate with the guitar, writing this song back on his hunting lease that he has south of Nashville. And it was so cool. He was like, oh, and he pulled out, he had like a diaphragm call in his truck, of course. And we were calling, you know, we called in this Jake. And it was just this amazing experience where I will always remember, you know, being in the woods with Andy Griggs calling, writing a song that he released the song too, which was cool. But, you know, I have written a couple sitting up in a tree stand myself though, because I, you know, you're sitting up there. That's what better thing to do to write something, you know? I at least write down ideas.
Yeah.
You know, I have what you call a hook book.
Okay.
And it's just ideas, you go, oh, that's a cool idea, and you jot that down, then you can reference it later when you're in a co-write.
Awesome, man. Well, you have a very unique lifestyle, and I'm glad you're a hunter.
Me too.
It's just, I don't know, a very unique perspective on what it means to be a hunter. I love listening, or I love talking with people, like anywhere from I've had a guy who on here, and he worked for a company that manufactured bombs for the Air Force. Okay. That was his job. Guys, you know, just guys who are on factory lines, guys who are white collar, blue collar, guys who have unique jobs like you. And so there's a lot of people who enjoy the outdoors and love hunting through all walks of life. And so that's my job, to get those people like you on here and let you, you know, let you tell your story. But man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day and sitting here and BSing with us today. If people want to find out more about you, because you got a website, where should we send them?
Definitely check out hawkinhorse.com. Hawkin with a E-N and horse as in the horse.com. And I'm on Instagram at Hawkin Horse Band, and on Facebook is just Hawkin Horse. Just type in Hawkin Horse and you'll find me in any music, you know, on Spotify, Apple, all that stuff. You'll find me there too. But you can also find, I write a lot of outdoor and history related articles in various magazines like Hook and Barrel and Muzzleloader Magazine. And anyway, you'll see my name, Andrew Scott Wills, in those places as well. But I'm a busy guy. I'm always writing something.
Perfect. Andrew, man, thanks for your time today.
Hey, Dan, thanks. It was an honor. Love the podcast, brother.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network. And this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.